nellbernstein.com. I also recently started a Substack at nellbernstein.substack.com, where I'm continuing to cover youth justice and also look at the question of movement building more broadly.
Great. Thanks so much, Nell, for joining us today on KBOO.
It's been really great talking with you.
That was Nell Bernstein, author of In Our Future, We Are Free. You're tuned to KBOO, where community voices matter. If you believe in what you've heard tonight, please help us stay on the air with your donation at kboo.fm/give. Independent voices depend on your support. Thanks so much.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. If you're able, please go to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution in support of the critical work of community radio. Thank you.
Don't know what to get your loved ones this season? Check out kboo.fm/merch to snag some KBOO swag to support community media in style. While you're shopping for gifts, you can make donations to help support KBOO's $75,000 goal for our KBOO Fights Back campaign now through December 31st.
Hey there, KBOO listeners. This is Dr. Tony Zimbardi, host of the new show, Radical Romance. Radical Romance is an advice show for folks who are in non-traditional relationships. Either you're in an open relationship or a polyamorous one, this is the show for you. Please call in. It airs every second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 10 a.m. Look forward to hearing from you. That's Radical Romance on KBOO Community Radio.
Hello, I don't even know your name, but I'm hoping all the same. This is more than just a simple hello.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
JVD, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. I want to bring attention to a ongoing case that involves somebody who's no stranger to our airwaves. His name is Minister King X. You know him as a community organizer with California Prison Focus and All of Us or None. Here's a lawsuit that is going against the state, and in particular, the prison system. And one of the interesting aspects of that, and something that's very disturbing, which I think all of us should sit up, is how he has been defined as a black identity extremist. We first heard that term several years ago, shortly after the Ferguson uprising is when I first started to hear it, and then you started to hear it some more around the time George Floyd was happening. labeling people a particular way is something that we should all be concerned about, especially now that we have an administration that is loosely calling people terrorists, enemies of the state, giving these extreme definitions, which then opens up a playbook that can put people in harm's way. Some people might be stripped of citizenship, sent off to a prison, detained indefinitely, be under mass surveillance, all sorts of things in that nature. And so I wanted to find out what is happening with Minister King's case. And I know y'all are having a big press conference to talk about this up in Sacramento. So we're catching you before that press conference. So Minister King, welcome to the show. And you also have your lawyer. Tell us a little bit about what's been happening and why we should be concerned.
Thank you for having me, Dave. And thank you, Eric, for showing up. So a few years back, when we had called for a demonstration to liberate our elder, who's no longer with us, but I'd like to say long live Rashiel McGee, and especially the work that we're doing in resistance to this whole prison slave complex, right? Prison slave industrial complex, I should say. During that time, the elder was going aboard, and it was around his birthday. And about a month later, unclothed agents came and kidnapped me from in front of my office on 45th and Market, where I was there taking out trash. They apprehended me and said that I had violated my parole. And I knew it was something strange about it because they was tight-lipped even when they took me to Santa Rita. But nevertheless, you fast forward it, they took me to Solano County and they finally told me, hey, we apprehended you because you did a peaceful protest. And in my mind, I thought that the Constitution was more than just a piece of paper. I thought you had the right to protest. I thought you had a First Amendment right, 14th Amendment right. I didn't know that I was going to be shackled and handcuffed for peacefully protesting. And then it got a little deeper, and we tried to figure that out through the policy and procedure of Penal Code 4571. And that's where we at right now. When anybody that's formerly incarcerated could be subjected, if you're standing adjacent to any county jail, adjacent to any prison, and you're doing any type of peacefully protest, that penal code discriminates. But I'm going to yield right there because I want my attorney, Eric, to go more in detail in that aspect.
Eric, well, welcome to the show. I kind of gave a synopsis as to my understanding, and King, of course, broke down some things. What else should we know about this case, and why is it important that all of us pay close attention to it?
Yes, as Minister King was mentioning, this state statute, Penal Code 4571, makes it a felony offense for anyone who has previously been incarcerated in the state prison to be present on lands adjacent to a prison or jail or other place where incarcerated persons are held without prior permission from the warden or sheriff who controls that facility. So basically, someone who's formerly incarcerated, otherwise, you know, free and has civil rights restored, is prevented from even exercising basic First Amendment freedoms like protesting, peacefully demonstrating, assembling with others to express their grievances on a public sidewalk. And that's exactly what happened to Minister King back in 2021 when he was in Solano County. And it's what continues, that statute continues to deter people from organizing and exercising their constitutional rights. And that's why we filed a suit in 2023, and that suit is ongoing. We've argued that that statute violates the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and also due process because of the vague contours of what is adjacent. Tomorrow, the 4th of December, there's a hearing in Sacramento at the federal court, the Eastern District of California Federal Court, where we will be arguing that the case should continue. The defendants, which include numerous employees of the California Department of Corrections and a county sheriff, the defendants are arguing that the case should be dismissed. We're, of course, opposing that motion, and that hearing will take place tomorrow afternoon. But before the hearing, there will be a press conference, and members of the public are encouraged to attend. That'll be about 12:30, probably gather around noon. Press conference proper will begin at 12:30 at the outside the federal courthouse at 500 I Street in Sacramento.
I just want to let people know we're doing this interview a day before they're doing the press conference. So just so you know, it's going to be airing tomorrow after you do your press conference. But we wanted to get the gist of what is happening in the larger issues that are connected to this, Eric. Let me ask you this. This law that prevents formerly incarcerated folks from being close to or in proximity of a prison, is this a new thing? Have there been a number of people that have been hemmed up because of this? And I'm asking, keeping in mind that folks like Minister King and others are part of a larger body of people who have been formerly incarcerated, who have been quite active in the past 10, 15 years, at least, you know, from where I can sit, you know, that have been very determined and very visible in terms of their activism and trying to turn things around. And sometimes it will involve some of the harsh conditions that are in prison. Sometimes it may be to bring attention to political prisoners or any number of things. But is this a way to send a chill and stifle that activism that we've seen with formerly incarcerated folks?
Yes, it very much is on the books to exert a chilling effect on incarcerated persons' activism. And that's why it's so important, we think, to challenge it constitutionally to have that statute's application declared unconstitutional. Now, it's been on the books actually since the 1940s. I would say more observed in terms of its silent effects. You know, it every once in a while they make an example out of someone like Minister King, and that, you know, serves as a deterrent effect for others, you know, just to make people hesitant to, you know, gather outside of jails or outside of prisons and hold mass rallies.
Is this selectively enforced? And I'm asking also, because, you know, I've been a lot of protests, you know, over the years. I've covered a lot of them in San Quentin, in other places. And there's definitely been people that have been formerly incarcerated that have been at some of these things. And that's why I'm really surprised to see that this has happened. I'm like, wow, you know, No, there's been hella protests, you know, from the time when Stanley Tookie Williams, there was a lot of protests there. There were definitely folks who had been formerly incarcerated at those rallies and beyond. So is this just something, as you said, to make an example out of an individual, or is this kind of the norm? They're pretty rigorous about enforcing this.
Well, because the statute is so broad and vague, there is a huge danger of selective enforcement. And in Minister King's case, the police report indicated that what the investigative unit, the investigative units of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, what they were targeting was what they called Black identity extremism. So they concocted this sort of amorphous category of Black identity extremism to try and tar persons seeking to exercise their civil and human rights as terrorists. You know, basically that's the kind of connotation that extremism has these days. You know, there was a series of hearings held by the federal government's Subcommittee on Crime, Terrorism, and Homeland Security just a few months prior to that, where there was a discussion of, in one of the early discussions of Antifa, which has recently been purportedly declared a domestic terrorist threat by the Trump administration. But back during the Biden era, there was this whole debate brewing about forms of domestic violent extremism, and the concept that there is such a thing as Black identity extremism is often put forward by the right as a way of deflecting criticisms of a very real phenomenon of white supremacist violence, which has historically been a feature of U.S. history. And at the time of the events in question in 2021, this theory of a Black identity extremism was sort of the operating rationale for the agents to surveil and target Minister King.
Well, what constitute a Black identity extremist? Either one of you, Minister King or Eric, you can answer that. I mean, what are they saying? They think you're going to show up and, you know, plant a bomb or something crazy like that? Or I'm just trying to figure out, how are you a threat?
So I like to add that, like, for years before my time, they had elders, as we talked about before on your show, they had elders that sat in solitary confinement for decades because of their worldview, for their school of thought. And this is why we had the hunger strike. So during that time, coming out of solitary confinement, it was hard for these particular elders to get granted for board, although these were principal thinkers that was promoting in the violence, in the hostilities during the time, even when it go back to Settle Your Quarrels. But it was because of that school of thought that, one, the state and government agents working under the color of law, they wanted to dismantle unity. So anything that looked it like something that was contrary to what the state was doing, they criminalized it. And I feel like our class for the last 30 plus years have developed solutions as well as programs. I mean, we have things that's designed to bring out into our community to show that we are not the worst of the worst, that we are not Black identity extremists, but we extremely love our people. We extremely love our community when we giving back, formerly incarcerated, giving back from cell block to city block. We promoting the street agreement to end all violence and hostilities. What we talking about, liberate our elders, the principal thinkers that's going inside of the schools and educating the youth. But they seeing us as a threat, right? And that's those that they say, okay, well, you go on inside of the police report and they say the IGI, Institutional Gang Investigator, said we have been watching Cage Universal. That's K, Cage Universal with a K on YouTube. And the information, the content, they criminalize it as Black identity extremist content. Well, on the YouTube, it's art, it's music, it's talking about liberation. You could go to Prison Focus Radio and you can hear the stories. You can look at the movie Strike. You can hear these stories of these elders talk about decades of elder abuse, decades of torture. One of the elders that they identified outside of Rochelle McGee is Lewis Powell. Lewis Powell been incarcerated for decades arbitrarily. We already know we all was born with subjected to a historical miscarriage. But Lewis Powell did decades in solitary confinement, not because of a crime, but because of his school of thought. So what they perceive as black identity extremists, we had to look at the lens of what Eric was just saying about KKK, for example. Is that white supremacy? Is that extreme, right? So, I mean, I'm not trying to be sarcastic or whatnot, but we got to just look at the facts. The facts is you have a person that's out there doing a peaceful protest to bring attention to this cruel and unusual punishment through the board, the state board, who fell or refused to give somebody their freedom, their true freedom, because of a 1030, because of somebody made a false claim. So people are afraid to protest now because of the Penal Code 4571. People are afraid to be criminalized. So it's going to take somebody to dare to struggle, to dare to win. You know, one of my elders, Abdul Shakur, he said, if you dare to sing, I had a song. If you dare to dance, I had a rhythm. If you dare to speak, I have the words. If you dare to be free, I know the way. So at 12 o'clock, we're going to be in Sacramento. We're going to be at the federal courthouse. We're going to have a press release. And we're going to expose the cruel and unusual punishment, expose the elder abuse, expose the decades of torture. Because this lawsuit isn't just about me, and it's not even about the formerly incarcerated. It's about the people that's attached to this caste system, this penal code that still upholds chattel slavery, this penal code that holds what we call imperialism.
Let me ask you this. What are some of the abuses that are going on? What has been happening that we should be aware of?
I know, like I just spoke on earlier, you have elders that spent over 30, 32, 35 years in solitary confinement because of their school of thought, and they criminalized them as being the worst of the worst. And the only way you was coming out of solitary confinement if you snitched, paroled, or died. That still stands, because one of the elders that I know who came home, Sitawa Natambo Jamaha, he had to come home through a stroke. He went to prison when he was 20-something years old. He came out in a wheelchair because he had a stroke. So what they're doing, Rochelle McGee, he came out after 67 years and he passed. And I mean, I want to salute all the freedom fighters that was able to bring him from one structure to the next. But we still got Mumia Abu-Jamal. We still got Joy Powell. We still got Lewis Powell. We still got Joker Ishima. We have these men and women where the community need to sit down and develop a strategic community release board where we could go in and do an assessment and get the data and look and see how many elders are incarcerated, men and women. And also, let's look at the youth that's going up inside the prison to make sure that they're not 50 or 60 years old. Make sure that we have real transparency.
Let me ask you this, either you, Minister King, or your lawyer, Eric. You're talking about something that is happening in the state. And I bring this up because here we have a governor right now who has been telling us we should be out in the streets. We should be protesting. We should be, you know, standing up, especially as we're seeing in very clear view authoritarianism, fascism taking root. It's been almost a call for all hands on deck. We also know that here in California, many people pride it as being a place that is forward-thinking and progressive and all these things that I guess can be attractive. And yet what I'm hearing is like, some of the things that we, in theory, should be protesting are being carried out right here in the state. And I'm scratching my head and I'm going, how can California, this state, have any sort of connection to troubling labels like black identity extremism when we just sat up here and saw people saying, you just can't arbitrarily declare people terrorists, and you can't lock up, you know, take fatal action, like, you know, putting bombs in boats and all these other things. So how is this happening in California, and who's the main force, or what group is the main force that has allowed this to happen? Either one of you can answer that, you, Eric, or Minister King.
I'll let Eric go, and then I'll respond after him.
So I think one of the paradoxes of liberal politics over many decades is that liberals are, you know, inclined to criticize overreach of power when it's done by others, but not when it's their own. And as a consequence, the assertions of power that, for example, Democratic administrations make for their own use then ends up being utilized by Republican administrations quite predictably to do things that then the Democrats decry as abuses of power. You know, we saw that with extraordinary renditions, which were begun under the Clinton administration and then perfected under the Bush 2 administration. We've seen that with targeted assassinations that, you know, the drone strikes that the Obama administration made a centerpiece of its counterterrorism policy, and now the Trump administration is carrying out murder in the Caribbean, targeting what they describe as drug boats from Venezuela. You know, this is a tried and true phenomenon. And so we shouldn't be too surprised that there's hypocrisy in California. I think Newsom's administration has done a lot of good things in challenging the federal government's overreach of, you know, National Guard deployment, its crackdown on immigration and so forth. Yet at the same time, you know, California has essentially a system of enslavement in the prisons through its exception clause to the ban on involuntary servitude. And, you know, the governor's office was not in favor of Prop 6, and Prop 6, you know, failed in 2024 to win at the ballot. So, yeah, there's a lot of injustice that remains in California, despite the nice rhetoric that we sometimes hear.
Appreciate that. Minister King, you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, first I want to uplift the actions taken by Barbara Lee during the time when she was in Congress. She was actually fighting against the FBI use of the term black identity extremist against Black Lives Matter at the time. And then I seen the progressive work that she started doing that was really compatible to the work that we was promoting, the end all hostilities, making Oakland clean and safe, creating community safety and liberation zones. So this always been the idea of the progressive thinker. The prisoners across the United States began during my time when we was resisting, before my time when the elders resisted. They will always say that they were all a part of the prisoner class. They began to realize that there was no way to survive that special brand of fascism. In particular, the California prison camps, except by beginning to run and struggle together. I mean, CDCR, the feds, they always had this conquering divide where they wanted to divide the family, divide the prisoners. And once they start seeing that, you know, the common goal for liberation and the desire for freedom helps to make them greater when they come together, people start realizing, hey, man, no matter what type of policy and procedure that we up against, we're going to have to fight it together as one. So when I came home, my journey to freedom began from within. But at the same time, I knew that that's part of the cause. You know, you coming up against a state, a fascist state, that want to have one set of people to say, well, we want to reform a system, and but at the same time, we got to go along to get along. But then you got some people that want to abolish this system as it stands. I send a shout out to Curve, how they want to shut down prisons and turn them into and put more money into education, you know? So I think at one point, you have to have the legislators in the room. You have to have the organizations in the room. You have to have all the principal thinkers, the reps that's here in California, and sit down and think about something that's feasible, that's going to work, versus criminalizing people and creating policy and procedure that discriminate and prohibits one to have adequate due process. Because when you think about due process, in the beginning of Penal Code 4571, there's no real fair and constructive notice. So here I am, I come home, they're on notice that I'm going to be working for an organization that advocates on behalf of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people. We create self-help programs. We publish the newspaper, California Prison Focus. We put this, we bolster the unheard voices on the radio. So they're aware of this, right? But then when we start performing this activity and start putting out criticism, then they try to find some type of arbitrary way to shut this down. And you're right, when we go inside of the prison, some people are selected and they say, well, we don't want you to go in there because of some reason. So when they're saying you got to give the sheriff or the warden fair notice, they're not allowing you to give them fair notice to go in there. So how could you begin to do a peaceful protest when they have barriers?
Right. You know, for folks like ourselves, this may be obvious, but I think it needs to be pointed out and wrestled with and realized. First, the concern, and you've alluded to this, is that these labels can be applied above and beyond those who are formerly incarcerated. It can be arbitrarily put on, you know, activists, organizers, educators, all that. And we've seen this. You know, your people in the classroom, they're saying Free Palestine, they want to put an incendiary label on them. We see people who are going to a protest, you know, and saying, I'm against the racism of, say, a Charlie Kirk. They're getting something put on them. And these things carry weight in ways that I don't think people can fully appreciate that. At the same time, and you mentioned this, you use the example of the KKK, and that, you know, many people don't see the KKK, but they do see militias, right? They do see Oath Keepers and, you know, other groups that were right here in California, right here in this state, that went up to the Capitol during COVID with rifles drawn, talking about, we don't want to mask up. We've seen these folks, you know, try to overturn an election by running up into the Capitol and threatening to hang, you know, elected officials during January 6th, right? We have folks who have aligned themselves with organizations that have called for the killing and removal of folks of color, women, gays, lesbians, the whole nine. So with that in mind, how should we approach the lack of labels being put on these folks while we have labels put on them? And I'm not sure if it's a thing of being satisfied when they go, okay, we're going to say militias or white identity extremists, but King, you're still a black identity extremist. There might be a missing step in there, and I'm just trying to figure out what, you know, how we should really start to look at organizations that I think are now being normalized and uplifted, that to me have always been, you know, terrorists in their activity.
Yeah, and I just want to add to that, like, when you think about the historical document, the agreement to end hostilities, you have four fractions of principal thinkers, and one of them is the Aryan Brotherhood, who signed on to our document. And crazy as it sounds, when I think about January 6th, I think about those principal thinkers who signed on to that document, who could say, hey, you know, we don't use the government to oppress the people. So it make you think about even within the administration that is gangsters in the White House, right? You think about the neo Nazism that's going on today. Has it always been there, right? So when you think about the poor white class, you think about the Hispanic class, you think about the Native American class, you think about people, the lumping and proletarian class, who've been subjected to decades of counterintelligence. What we're dealing with today is counterintelligence 2.0. We're dealing with the Smith Act today. And these things are ongoing, and it takes organization, it takes the church, it takes the clergymen and women, it takes the law student, it takes the mosque, it takes people to come and sit down and say no more. And you have to have people of all walks of life that cover down. This is why you have All of Us and None that's on front line. You have LSPC, California Prison Focus, on front line taking this risk. When many others, they're stray from this because, again, as you alluded to, a lot of people know about this hashtag because that's what I look at it. They put these names on us, and it's up to us if we own them or not. I don't walk in the light as whatever they say we are. We are our own liberators, so nobody define who we are. But I know that I'm going to resist fascism, and I feel that in order for us to see some type of change, whether we win through this lawsuit or not, we have to have more people involved from the inside and out. And we have right. to begin to have these conversations.
Well, it's more than just conversations. And Erica, you can also comment on this as well. First, I appreciate the fact that, you know, there's been some historical, you know, breakdown of things so that we understand that this has been, these actions have been on a trajectory, you know. And I think what we forget, and maybe it's because people aren't fully aware or people have brought into stereotypes that have been levied on people. But here in this state, for a long time, they were, especially in Southern Cali, they would arrest entire neighborhoods over a weekend and then say, well, you live on A Street and you live on B Street, and we're just going to classify you as a member of the A Street gang and the B Street gang. And you know, the way that that played out for people is that something routine, maybe you get pulled over, and then they go, oh, that's a gang member. We better bring extra backup, and we're going to have to approach them in a whole other different way. Maybe it gets leaked out somewhere, and all of a sudden you can't get a job because you're in this database. And I remember in L.A., you know, they had half the black male population under 40 in a gang database with many people not knowing. And so we don't know, especially with this administration, if we are in some sort of category. And what does that mean? If I show up to the airport, do they have some sort of identifier next to my name that says I can't have a passport or can't even get on a flight? And these things are starting to happen, not just because you were formerly incarcerated, but because you have a political stance that they deem to be threatening. So if I say I don't believe in capitalism, all of a sudden I have a jacket on me. And this is why I think we should all be concerned, and just being able to look back at recent history to see how it disrupted entire communities and ruined the lives of people in particular generations on this type of labeling when people didn't even know it. So, Eric, any thoughts on that? And what would you ask people to do to help fight back in the ways that you all are doing?
Well, I think that's a great reminder that there's a whole history of repression. COINTELPRO is maybe the classic example of how COINTELPRO that, you know, came to light in the 70s, but had been going on for quite a while before, you know, was a program whereby the FBI would surveil groups largely on the left that were arguing for civil rights, such as, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and the anti-war movement, and all kinds of social movements largely on the left that were deemed a threat to the established order as it was perceived by the FBI. Of course, like half a century earlier than that, there was the Red Scare, when around the time of the Russian Revolution, anarchists, socialists, communists, and syndicalist groups were considered the main threat, and a lot of the early battles around free speech in the teens and 20s had to do with what they called criminal syndicalism laws that were deployed to prevent people who were, you know, protesting, for example, World War I, who, you know, socialists who viewed the First World War as a kind of contest between capitalist imperial forces that the working class shouldn't participate in. That kind of speech was often banned, and persons like Eugene Debs were put into prison. You know, so we've seen again and again where labels, whether it be criminal syndicalism back then or extremism today, become a pretext for state repression. I think we need to resist labels like extremism because they encompass way too much. The legal standard, isn't extremism or non-extremism when it comes to advocacy that can be lawfully or at least constitutionally proscribed. There's the law of incitement. So there's a pretty strict legal standard for when speech crosses the line and loses constitutional protection. So if someone is inciting violence, meaning that they are urging an illegal act and it is imminent and likely to occur, that is incitement and loses its constitutional protection. But everything short of that, advocacy, calling for the overthrow of the government, isn't, you know, automatically incitement. It's rather a political ideology, and it's protected speech. So, you know, I can say, you know, I hope the capitalist order is, falls in a communist revolution. That's protected speech. If I say this person should be killed, and it's likely that what I say is going to be taken seriously and possibly acted on, then that's a different story. That's incitement and can be proscribed. But, you know, whether something is extremist or not is neither here nor there from a constitutional perspective. And right. The use of that and the use of that label by law enforcement means that it's going to often step over the line into unconstitutional activity.
Yeah, definitely. And I appreciate you noting that. And again, I remind folks, people who got those labels, it just being called a gang member meant that, again, a routine traffic stop could turn into something a whole lot more because somebody put that label on you. And it wasn't based upon anything you did, but it had everything to do with where you lived. And so playing loose with that can have serious ramifications. And we've seen that kind of play out in a different iteration in 2025. So we should all be concerned. Eric, I appreciate you taking time out. And let me just end things with Minister King.
Thank you.
Minister King, it's one of the things I wanted to get your comments on this. December 4th is the birthday, Chairman Fred Hampton, and you talked about people of different factions coming together. We'd be remiss not to uphold the fact that it was him that was probably one of the more visible folks who started a rainbow coalition, bringing different people from backgrounds together and really focusing attention on a common oppressor versus having people go at each other. At the same time, this was a person that was in the crosshairs. His speech, his activities, probably in 2025 would have him be identified as a black identity extremist, and not because he's advocating for anything other than for people to unify and come together. So just your thoughts as we kind of reflect a little bit on his date of birth, December 4th.
Yeah, you know, fighting criminalization triggers a lot of trauma. And when you think about the chairman, Fred Hampton, I think about when he said, you can't have revolution without peace, and you can't have peace without revolution. And he was talking about a time when he wanted to see black power for the black people, brown power for the brown people, red power for the red people, and even white power for the poor white people. So that's what I was alluding to when I said that George said, settle your quarrels. You have these principal thinkers had a different school of thought. And they was using their school of thought to bring in an understanding that we are one people. It's about shared humanity, Ubuntu. You know, I just say that I'm one of thousands, one of many formerly incarcerated returning citizens who's working to establish a voters block, who's working to establish a political prisoners political action committee. I've paid my debt twofold. I'm no longer paying my debt to society. I'm now paying a debt to a secret confederacy within CDC small r. So in the spirit of Fred, I just feel that we got to continue to build in our community. We got to continue the nation build and understand that this struggle is nothing that's going to be gone just today or tomorrow. And we got to dare to struggle, dare to win.
Minister King X, we appreciate you taking time out. If people want to follow you all for more information, is there a website or any place they can tap in?
Yes, you could go to LSPC, Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, All of Us or None. You could also follow, we're going to live stream on my page. That's Instagram, official Minister King X Pie Face. Poor Magazine is gonna live stream, and I may have forgot others, but you also could go and see some of the information on San Francisco Bayview.
Okay, well, we definitely will follow up on those, and we appreciate you taking time out this afternoon, my brother. Okay.
All right, thank you.
Ralph for now. Peace.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
And my last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
I'm the deputy chairman of the state of Illinois Black Panther Party, Fred Hampton. And a lot of people don't understand the Black Panther Party's relationship with white mother country radicals. A lot of people don't even understand that word that Elvis uses a lot. What we're saying is that there are white people in the mother country that are for the same type of things that we are for, assimilating revolution in the mother country. And we've said that we'll work with anybody, form coalition with anybody that has revolution on their mind. We're not a racist organization because we understand that racism is an excuse used for capitalism. And we know that racism is just is a byproduct of capitalism. Everything would be all right if everything was put back in the hands of the people. And we're going to have to put it back in the hands of the people.
Rolling streets of Chicago, a voice rose loud. German Fred standing strong and proud. He built up the people, gave them away. Yeah. Fighting for justice every single day.
get breakfast, healthcare on the right. It's all through the system, it's all through their lives.
Jeffrey's a hero.
Jeffrey's a hero.
You can just lie.
Chapman Fred, you never did fall. In the face of oppression, you answered the call.
Yes, I'm cold.
They feared your power and your call to unite. They couldn't break your will to stand up and fight. The Rainbow Coalition, it was you who led the way. Bring brothers and sisters together to stay. With Chairman Fred, Chairman Fred. Chairman Fred, Chairman Fred.
If I do go, if you don't say anything else, then the last thing I heard him say was that you can jail revolutionary, but you can't jail revolutionary. Yeah, you can lock up a freedom fighter, but you can't lock up freedom fighters. You can run a liberator around the country, but you can't run liberation around the country. And if you do, you come up with answers that don't answer, explanations that don't explain, and conclusions that don't conclude.
At 4 o'clock on Thursday morning, December 4th, 1969, Chicago police entered Chairman Fred Hampton's apartment and killed him while he was asleep in his bed. They also killed Brother Mark Clark, defense captain of the Peoria, Illinois Black Panther Party, and wounded four other Panther brothers and sisters. Fred Hampton and Mark Clark are not the first revolutionaries to die in the struggle for freedom. 28 Panthers have been killed by police across the nation in the last year and a half. In Chicago, the week of Ho Chi Minh's death, a Panther, Larry Roberson, was killed by police. Fred Hampton spoke about the life of a revolutionary at a Ho Chi Minh memorial rally.
We feel the same way Larry Roberson felt when Larry Roberson said, "I don't care what anybody says, be it my mother, my father, my family, be it the pigs, be it other members of the Black Panther Party. I feel like hungry children should be fed, not because they have money, but for the simple reason that they're hungry." That's why Larry Roberson is dead. We got a thing, the Black Panther Party, that we talk about being so revolutionary, proletarian, intoxicated, that we cannot be astronomically intimidated. The way that you get so revolutionary, proletarian, intoxicated, the way that you get high off the people, is because many people in the Black Panther Party have found a certain potion that our Minister of Health mixed up. Our Minister of Health is Dr. Feelgood, if y'all don't know it. Ron Satchel. I know y'all heard about the People's Health Clinic is gonna be opening up the 28th of this month, and that People's Health Clinic is opening up because of Dr. Feelgood. That's right. We went into the community and told the community, "What do you think about all the diseases that's running rampant in the community? All the early child deaths that's running rampant in the oppressed community? What do you think about the high bills? What do you think about doctors that think about public wealth instead of public health?" And you know what the people told us? They said, "Don't send us no doctors," filling us up with all of those damn pills, because that will never, ever, ever cure the people's ill. Send us little Ron Satchel. Send us Dr. Feelgood from the Black Panther Party. And that's what we send them. We send them Dr. Feelgood in 28th of this month. Dr. Feelgood is going to show you where it's at. But open up that People's Health Clinic. We're not going to be charging nobody. People ain't got to fill out no questionnaire and have to prove who they are and prove that they're poor. We're not going to go to their house and tell them you got to show us so many rats before you can get the treatment. It's not going to be anything like that. We're going to set up a situation that people will be cured because they're sick. Simple as that. A lot of you people are going to have to make a commitment. And it's not a hard commitment to make, is it? It's either Everett Dixon or Ho Chi Minh. It's either Lyndon Baines Johnson or Mao Zedong. That's not no hard commitment to make, is it? It's either Richard Nixon or Fidel Castro. And right here in the city of Chicago, it's either Bobby Rush, the Minister of Defense for the Black Panther Party, or Jesse L. Jackson, or from Operation Breadbasket. Ho Chi Minh is dead because he was fighting for peace. Everybody know that. He was tired of fighting for peace. Larry Roberson is dead because he was a fighter for peace. They'll tell you that these brothers here were warmongers. They have the trick of making themselves look like the angel and making you look like the devil, which is only to say that they make the devil look like the angel and make the angel look like the devil. And I'm telling you that just as our motto says, we don't believe in war. We're against war. We understand that the only way to stop war is to gain in war. We don't dig a gun, but the way to get rid of a gun, make a man get rid of a gun, is for you yourself to pick up a gun. This is what anybody that calls themselves a revolutionary or one who supports a revolution, anybody that does that understands what we're talking about. It's nothing hard to understand. Many of you people get hung up and you are racking your brains about who to follow and who not to follow are nothing but a bunch of people that's bullshit. Because it's very clear who to follow. It's very clear who the enemy is attacking viciously, who the enemy is painting black. And it's very clear who the enemy is playing up and saying he's an all right guy. They will not wipe out the Black Panther Party because, as our chairman Bobby Seale says, as long as there's any black people, one black person in the world, there will be a Black Panther Party. Larry Roberson said, no longer can I allow the pigs to brutalize the people in Long. He felt the same way that Huey P. Newton felt. And he did the same thing that Huey P. Newton would do. And Larry Roberson said that I'm standing here on my constitutional rights. And the only thing that can move me will be death. And there's nothing wrong with death, because if I can't find anything worth dying for, then I'm not fit living. I'm ready to make a commitment now. I'm only 20 years old, but if I live to 80 and I never make a commitment, I'll be dead anyway. If I live till I'm 99, I know that I died at 20, because all those other years that I lived not knowing I made a commitment, it would be nothing but a season of your breathing.
In the realm of the airwaves, where the truth does spin,
Hard Knock Radio takes the mic. Let the dialogue begin.
From the heart of the culture,
I love you, K-Boo.
This is Bird Note. When the air is thick with wildfire smoke, people are advised to stay home. But birds don't have weather apps, so what do? Acorn woodpeckers are extremely social. They live in family groups that cooperate to raise young and to cache food in a communal granary. They often visit their neighbors, too, which can help young birds find mates or establish new territories. To study these social networks, scientists have been using tiny radio transmitters to track the movements of acorn woodpeckers in a nature preserve near Monterey, California. In the summer of 2020, when nearby wildfires blanketed the area in heavy smoke, the birds responded to poor air quality, much like people do. On smoky days, woodpeckers spent more of their time at home, and when they did leave their territories, they didn't venture far and visited fewer neighbors than usual. The researchers calculated that from 2016 to 2020, almost 90% of the U.S. range of acorn woodpeckers experienced similarly smoky conditions at some point each year. That's a lot of birds whose lives and community ties are being disrupted by wildfire smoke. Learn more about what you can do to help ensure that we all have clean air to breathe when you visit our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to our KBOO Fights Back campaign. Help KBOO reach our $75,000 goal by December 31st so we can bring you